Welcome to Quimper UU Fellowship. We hope you enjoy this recording from our January 26th, 11 a.m. service. Our guest speakers are a husband and wife team, Michael Dowd and Connie Barlow. Their sermon title is Finding Meaning in the Dark. The music following the sermon is The Prophet Bird from Forest Scenes by Robert Schumann, performed by Akui Goldstein. Thanks for listening.
Good morning. Two readings this morning, the first from Wendell Berry. To know the dark. To go in the dark with a light is to know the light. To know the dark, go dark. Go without sight. And find that the dark, too, blooms and sings and is traveled by dark feet and dark wings. An eagle poem from Joy Harrow. To pray, you open your whole self to sky, to earth, to sun, to moon, to the one whole voice that is you. And know there is more that you can't see, can't hear, can't know except in moments steadily growing and in languages that aren't always sound, but other circles of motion. Like eagle that Sunday morning over Salt River, circled in blue sky, in wind, swept our hearts clean with sacred wings. We see you. See ourselves, and know that we must take utmost care and kindness in all things. Breathe in, knowing we are made of all this, and breathe, knowing we are truly blessed because we were born and die soon within a true circle, a moment of motion, like eagle rounding out the morning. Inside us, we pray that it will be done in beauty. In beauty.
The title of this talk that we're giving is Finding Meaning in the Dark. And that is just such a lousy title, I'm realizing now. It's so much more than meaning. And the darkness is not what we normally think about when we hear dark and a sense of grief. This is not about the individual level of grief and suffering and tremendous catastrophe that is common to human existence, especially if we've been blessed with many decades. Things have happened. This is about something that we're pretty much all feeling now, and our ancestors that we've known in the past, not just the ones way, way, way back, really haven't been able to prepare us for. Probably a better title would have been an opinion piece that was in the New York Times by Michelle Goldberg just 2 days ago, January 24th. She titled her piece, The Darkness Where the Future Should Be. Short version of that might be what happens when we confront the death of expectations. Underlying that more conceptually, the death of our worldviews, the disruption in our world. What's it all about now? Who are we? What's our sense of legacy? What can we do now that the situation has changed? Michael and I want to make this a very practical time. He and I are engaged in a joint project together, which he'll talk with you more about. But we want to make it practical in the inner sense. in the inner sense, because we are privileged to be able to spend almost full time on this because of the project that we're involved in. What I want to do to start off is just give you something that I have learned, which is really important for me, and maybe important for you, either for where you are in your sense of how things are and how things are unfolding or will unfold, or someone in your life who you're having trouble communicating with now, who just, they're just not there. We sometimes will say, well, they're just apathetic. They're not willing to talk about the koalas in Australia. They're not willing to talk about climate change overall or what's happening. They're just apathetic. They're not in denial anymore. It'd be pretty darn hard to be in denial anymore, but they're just apathetic. I refuse to use that word anymore. I'm a science writer. I am not trained at all in psychology or counseling, but what I realize now is that a lot of what expresses as apathy is really protective, psychological, not even controllable things to protect ourselves from the kind of despair that could arise if we really have to deal with it. One of the terms that I really love that a woman, Damaris Zehner, wrote a blog about very recently, she calls it visceral denial. It's not up here in the left brain. Some scientists, you know, say, no, it's like you've been hearing things passing along. You're not looking for it, but you can't avoid it. Okay, it's coming your way. But it's so deep, like, oh no, that you just, it's a visceral that you're not willing to talk about it, you're not willing to think about it. You've got lots of other things you can do in your life, okay? Another thing that's a possible term for this is selective inattention, which is really adaptive. Selective inattention. We're so busy, we've got so many things to do. Selective inattention. And then beyond that, really functional distractions. Functional distractions. This is very, very difficult. And especially, I've been blessed. Since 2012, when we woke up to climate change, I could immediately use my writing skills and then eventually use my video editing skills to do something. I can do something. I don't just have to feel, oh, just despair. I can do something. Not everyone has that to step into. And if they don't, if there isn't peers that they can join with, such as Olympic Angels to help individuals, that they can immediately join into, you just don't want to admit it. So selective inattention, let's not dismiss people as apathetic.
Stephen Jenkinson, the legendary grief walker, palliative care expert up in Canada, who has helped people to embrace a science-based, native, indigenous way of holding mortality, impermanence, and death. He's focused in recent years on climate and our relationship to our own climate grief and societal contraction grief. And he says, this is a quote, he says, inattention, like not paying attention, inattention to our world's ecological plight is well advised. Because attention to it mitigates against your happiness, your contentment, and your sense of well-being. To awaken in our age is a grief-soaked proposition. To awaken in our time is to awaken with a sob. However people have thought of what awakening means, an enlightenment experience, an awakening, throughout most of human history, or at least those cultures or traditions that use that kind of language, it was usually about, ah, or whoa, or mmm. So to say that to awaken, to have an awakening experience, an enlightenment experience in our time, that is to come to see the nature of reality in a deeper, fresher, more accurate way, is to awaken with a sob, which is to say that it's at the heart level. So finding meaning in the dark isn't just merely intellectual, it's a head and heart thing, or to use another analogy, it's the two halves of our brain. One side of our brain, which is really good at understanding things and treating disparate entities as separate parts, and then the other half of our brain, which is about holism and understanding the relationship between the parts. But since the Enlightenment, since the last several hundred years, we've really favored the rational, verbal, data-driven side of our brain and have poo-pooed or disvalued the meaningful, inspiring, the mythic parts of our brain, the part that looks for pattern and where relationships are more important than facts. Some scientists have spoken it as practical truth and factual truth, that one half of our brain, the rational verbal side, is all about, and what science is really great at and helps us do, is understand the nature of reality. Myth, or at least if myth is doing its job, which it usually hasn't been doing in recent centuries, but myth is about helping us to relate to reality. And both sides of our brain are needed for the same reason that myth and science, evidence. So science gives us factual truth, factual realism. Myth, religion when it's doing its job, that is when religion is about helping us as a community to grieve together what needs to be grieved, to celebrate together what needs to be celebrated, and where we collectively can be a blessing to our larger community. Religion is helping us to relate to what is fundamentally, undeniably, and inescapably real. And so I want to just draw out just three things that have to do with this post-doom conversation series that Connie and I are engaged in. I've had 60 conversations with some of the world's leaders, including Joanna Macy. We just posted that last week. But some of the most amazing leaders of people who get the big picture, they understand contraction, they understand collapse, they understand climate change, and indeed abrupt climate change, which is where you have 10,000 years of climate change in one human lifetime. They get all that. They've moved through whatever stages of grief they needed to move through to be in compassionate, fearless action. So as I think about it, there's several principles that many Unitarian Universalists, I would say most Unitarian Universalists, have, and the post-doom wisdom that we're gaining from these interviews, these conversations. And I'll go into this a lot more tomorrow night, but just very briefly. We Unitarians, we're not stuck where so many of the religious people in the English-speaking world are, which is we're not tied to what I call the triple idolatries. Idolatry of the otherworldly, idolatry of the written word, and idolatry of beliefs. All of those reflect human-centeredness rather than life-centeredness, ecocentrism. Turns out all sustainable cultures, we don't know any counterexamples, are life-centered. They're not human-centered. As soon as we start measuring progress and success in human-centered terms, individual wealth, corporate wealth, nation-state power, or anything else, we're on an unsustainable path. We're on a self-destructive path. And we're ultimately on an ecocidal path. So idolatry of the written word is when you think where God's best guidance, that is our best map of reality, is frozen in some ancient scripture. Idolatry of the otherworldly is where you think reality, ultimate reality, exists is only outside time and nature. And idolatry of beliefs is when you privilege beliefs over knowledge. When you think religion is about believing or disbelieving anything. Indigenous peoples were not belief-based religion. It was experience-based religion. And it was reflected in a humility that basically said, we belong to the land, and our job is to preserve the well-being of the land. The hubris of human-centeredness is, the land belongs to us. We can do what we want with it, because that's progress. And we now know that that's suicidal, that's ecocidal. So the first thing that Unitarians have in common with these post-doom experts is a grounding of authority in evidence, not old men or old books. And the second thing is an expansion of identity, like who we are. What do we mean when we say myself? Many Unitarians, and certainly many of these post-doom people, are all about a sense of self, as in indigenous cultures, where our sense of self doesn't stop with our skin. That we are part of a lineage of evolution, that we are evolution becoming conscious of itself. We're part of evolution. And evolution will continue even when our species goes extinct, which of course we will. It may happen in the next 50 years. It may not happen for another 2 million years, but our species is going to go extinct. And evolution will continue, and life will continue. And we can trust that in the same way that we trust our own mortality. So grounding of authority in evidence, recognizing an identity with the past and with the future, and then with that, a commitment to do whatever we can to be a blessing to the future rather than a curse to the future. And then finally, an identity with nature, the nesting dolls. When I spoke here in the fall, I spoke about the nested nature of reality and that we are part of that. So we recognize that we, you know, that Michael Dowd isn't just here, that Michael Dowd doesn't exist without my microbiome. That you don't exist, none of us exists without the trees that give us oxygen, the plankton that give us oxygen, the plants and animals that feed us. In other words, we are interrelated and interdependent with a larger body of life that is our larger self. And that sense of identity with time and nested self grounds us so that we can grieve together. Because our grief, as Joanna Macy reminds us and as the Robin Wall Kimmerer quote reminded us, grief tells us how much we love. We wouldn't love if we didn't grieve. And when communities grieve together, there is a bond that's more powerful than anything else. Even the word compassion means suffering with. When we grieve together, then we can be about the work of fearless action. And I'll conclude this sermon just a little bit on that. But fearless action rather than in order to activism. Fear-based activism. They're very different.
Another practical side to this from the inner is something I've picked up by one of the interviews that we've done and that I've edited. There's a couple young women, Americans, who've started something called the Good Grief Network. The Good Grief Network. And what they do, they're drawing from a variety of sources, but including a lot of the sort of 12-step recovery ways of moving through. But they've adapted it for grief. And they've adapted this. This is not, you know, do something Kubler-Ross if you've got an individual. This is for their peers, the millennials. They're doing it for their peers who are having to see the future evaporate or are wondering whether to go to college or wondering whether they should have kids or not. I mean, all these things that just weren't there for my generation. The Good Grief Network. They've gotten quite a bit of press. But what I really started to think about there was how important it is to help peer groups form that truly are peers. I mean, we like to think that we can talk with everyone. No. No. And I'll give you an example of where I think it's very important for boomers and beyond to not assume that we can have really significant conversations, except with our kids, our grandkids, with the younger generations. And here's why. When I look at what's going on with our civilization, with our economy, with climate and other environmental concerns, I am no longer where I was in the 50s and 60s. I just assumed this. I'm really here, okay? But for me, it's abstract. I'm not feeling it yet, and I'm not going to live into it. I really don't think I'm going to have to change my life in any way that I'll be gone, okay? Or I'll be willing to be gone when it happens, okay? I'll step forward and say, hey, okay, I'm willing to be gone. It's abstract, it's a big concern, we're worried about our kids and grandkids, and yet we don't have to think about how we are going to survive in those times. It's abstract. For them, they do. They've got immediate problems. Do I want to invest in getting into student debt to get an education where I know a bachelor's degree won't get me anything anymore and I'm going to have to keep getting a master's and maybe I'm going to have to get a PhD? Not my generation. That wasn't there. Michael, just this summer, fortunately, he had a wonderful conversation with his youngest daughter, who knows how intrepid climate activists we are, and he assured her that it would be fine for her and her husband to have a child. She's 29, had just turned 29. Well, about a month after that, she got pregnant. These kinds of things are so important to recognize the distinctions, okay? So if we can help young people have their peer groups for discussing and supporting each other, including the Good Grief Network, just Google Good Grief Network, they do things online as well. But for us boomers, I think there's one other thing that we need to recognize. I had to go through this. And that's when I really got climate changed. I looked back at my legacy. I'm retired as a science writer. I knew some of my books were in university libraries around the world. And I looked back at that and I said, whew, good firewood. Now, you don't have to go there, but just recognize some of us do, and we're concerned about how do we interpret what we've done in our lives. And what opportunities are available for us to step forward and have a legacy, even if we're retired, that touches individuals, and especially here in our communities, even if we're retired from where we have a big voice in the world anymore.
So in winding this sermon down, I want to come back to the Wendell Berry quote that to find the blessing in the dark itself, not merely for how that will eventually get us to the light, to use those metaphors. And I want to define what I mean by doom and post-doom, because our activism, and not just our activism, a pre-doom mind and a post-doom mind are very different. A pre-doom heart and a post-doom heart are very different. And pre-doom living and post-doom living are very different. So I want to conclude this just a little bit here, and then again, I'll be going into this. There's one inaccuracy, which is in the bulletin, it says that I'll be doing a multimedia presentation tomorrow night. I'm sharing some really new stuff tomorrow evening, that will be the core of my message, the heart and soul of the message I'll be speaking on throughout 2020. And I've only done this once before. This was 2 weeks ago in Hood River, a large church there, United Church of Christ congregation. And I didn't use any slides, and I just shared my heart, and we spent a lot of time and back and forth. And it was so meaningful. Some of us were moved to tears a couple times. It was profound. And I want you to help co-create with me the heart and soul of my message tomorrow night. So it won't be multimedia, but I'll be going into this a lot more depth, especially in terms of how we got here, why we're in the mess we are now, what is possible and what's really not possible in the future. Because if we are investing in things that are really not possible, we're going to keep finding ourselves really frustrated. So it's kind of like that old 12-step prayer. Life, help me accept the things I can't change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. So we'll go into that tomorrow night. But I just want to talk about the terminology. Most people avoid what I call the doom doorway because they think it's the end. They think if they allow themselves to feel true deep grief, deep sadness, even despair, they'll stay there the rest of their lives. And so they do anything they can to avoid letting the information in, letting the reality of climate chaos and societal breakdown, political insanity, economic insanity, they let they kind of keep it at bay for exactly the reasons Connie said. It's functional. It's adaptive to not pay attention to that stuff. But if we allow ourselves to feel the stages of grief, over top of the door that you know we know is the doom door, it says WASF. And we know what that means, which is why we don't go through the door. Because it says, we are so, right? The paradox is when we allow ourselves through that door and find ourselves in the place of fearlessness, because we're already at peace with the fact that, of course, our species is going to go extinct. There may be pockets of us that last another 1 million or 2 million years, but we could go extinct this century, and that's a real possibility. And we're now at peace with that, even though we know that there's going to be difficulty. Once we know that, then we are fearless in our activism. That's post-doom activism. Post-doom living comes out of fearlessness. It's no longer victimized. It's no longer, why is this happening? Why do we have this president? Why do we have this insane political, economic, like, insanity? Because we begin to understand, oh, this is the way unsustainable civilizations contract. So then we're open to that engaged action from compassion and generosity and fearlessness. And then the paradox is we look back and that door that we thought was the end, we now see as the midpoint, because that's what doom is. Doom is the midpoint between denial and regeneration. With or without us, life will regenerate. Worst case scenario, we have a nuclear war, all of our nuclear power plants melt down, all humans go extinct, 90% of the other animals go extinct. Within 10 million years, that's 1 month on a cosmic century timeline, Earth will have fully regenerated. So life can be trusted. So doom is the midpoint between denial and regeneration. The paradox is on the other side of the post-doom doorway, you look back and you see WASF. But now you experience it as we are so fortunate to be alive and to be conscious and to be engaged with big hurting hearts, because that's where we find our compassion, that's where we find our suffering with, and that's where we as communities are engaged. Because here's the thing, whether you are aware of this or not, whether you are still to some degree in denial of this or not, we are in the early stages of the most significant mental health crisis in human history, where millions of our neighbors, our friends, and our family members who are still in some or another form of functional denial, adaptive denial, they're going to wake up at some point. It seems every season there's going to be a few million more, or maybe many millions of more, that get it, that didn't get it before. So many people, I know people who are in the Fox News climate denialist camp, my mother, some of my family members, who could not help feeling compassion for the billions of animals that are dying, the people that are suffering all over the world from these fires that are now out of control. So that's what I mean. When people have to let go of the myth of perpetual progress, when they no longer genuinely believe that Star Trek is our future, that's the death of a worldview. That's what Connie started this sermon on, the death of expectations. And it's congregations like you all that have done the grief work, that have done the heart work, that are accepting of the possibility, well, the inevitability of collapse, because we're already into that, the likelihood of it being really difficult, and the possibility of human extinction in the not-too-distant future, and then are engaged fearlessly as compassionate, not just social justice people, but also intergenerational justice people, committed to doing everything we can to be a blessing to the future. And knowing that when you interview people who have gone through previous contractions and collapses of either economies or societies or cultures, many of them, the vast majority, find it was the most meaningful, important times of their lives, because we needed to rely on each other. We needed to support each other. We felt connection. Because finding meaning in the dark sometimes means you're in a dark room and all you do is find the hand of someone and you can feel that they're with you.
finding a heart, holding and feeling that connection, and then growing in our intimate reconciliation, readaptation, coming home to life as divine. And that's, again, the last place where I think Unitarian Universalists and many of these post-doom people have a common ground, is we recognize that the divine isn't merely up there, out there some way. The divine is present in every living creature, and the divine is present behind every set of eyes, human and non-human. And that's holy ground. And again, I'll go into a lot more of this tomorrow night. Amen.